Gill asked if Robert had described the murder to him.
"The first time he told me he had no recollection of stabbing her," said Walker, "but remembered hitting her on the head with a truncheon. On another occasion he told me that he had stabbed her."
This was the first time that the truncheon had been cited as a murder weapon. Perhaps this, rather than the knife or the pillow, had been the means by which Robert had finally dispatched his mother after Natty heard her groan. The police doctor had not mentioned finding a head injury during the post-mortem, but Mary Jane Burrage had referred to seeing a horrible wound on her friend's temple. Grantham intervened to ask Walker if he could explain why Robert had claimed that he had hit her with a truncheon.
"His different accounts of the crime showed loss of memory," said Walker.
"Are you of opinion that he was not of sound mind?" asked Grantham. The judge interrupted before Walker could reply.
"That is a matter on which the jury must form their own conclusion," he said.
Walker had frequently been permitted to give his opinion on a defendant's insanity in the Old Bailey courts, but Kennedy, implementing the most rigorous interpretation of the law, would not allow it. Gill asked Walker a last question about Robert. Was it compatible with insanity that the boy took himself off to Lord's on the day that he murdered his mother?
"I could not conceive anyone going to Lord's cricket ground and acting as the lad did after committing such a crime if he were sane," returned Walker.
Walker's reply went to the heart of the puzzle of the murder. Robert's coolness before and after the killing could be read as evidence of culpability, and yet his very indifference might be the strongest sign that he was mad. Charles Gill asked Dr. Walker for his assessment of John Fox. The doctor said that Fox had a badly shaped head and a highly arched palate. "He is slow in understanding what is said to him," he added, "and does not know common things you would expect an ordinary man to know. He is slow of apprehension. He has the peculiar hesitation in speech often noticed in weak minds." Grantham's next witness was John Joseph Griffin, medical attendant to the Coombs family since 1893. Dr. Griffin was an Irish-born bachelor, aged 40, who lived and worked in a large terraced house in the Barking Road. He was the author of the sick note for Emily Coombs that Robert had altered in July. Griffin testified that Emily Coombs was a hysterical woman, very emotional and subject at times to fits of crying and laughing. She used to laugh and cry with the least exciting cause. She was generally of a weak and nervous disposition. He agreed that the nervous disposition and temperament of the mother sometimes affects the children, but stopped short of saying that Robert had inherited her weakness. Griffin told the court how he had treated Robert for the disordered nervous system and attacks of mental excitement due to cerebral irritation that his predecessor, Dr. Coward, had diagnosed. Robert's father usually brought him to a consultation, Griffin said, though the boy sometimes came with his mother.
"When the attacks were on him," said Griffin, "he had an irresistible impulse to run away without reason. I advised the father to take him to sea for a trip in consequence of those attacks."
By echoing Walker's use of the phrase irresistible impulse, Griffin supported the defense case that Robert had moments in which he could not control his actions. Yet the supposed symptom, the desire to run away without reason, looked less like madness than misery. Griffin may even have perceived that Robert's problems were related to his mother. After all, he prescribed a journey that would enable him to escape her influence. Justice Kennedy said that it seemed obvious that Robert was not suffering from mania.
"I never saw him in any condition of mania," acknowledged Griffin. "What I know is from what the father stated to me. He said his boy used to get up in the morning and complain of severe headache, and was restless, fidgety, and excitable, and twitching in his limbs. His father used to put him to bed. I gave him bromide of potassium to calm him."
Bromide of potassium was a sedative and depressant used to treat disorders of the brain.
This was the medication that Amelia England had fetched for Robert when he became agitated. Though recommended in the Dictionary of Psychological Medicine as a safe drug, prolonged use could cause a condition known as bromism. The symptoms included stupor, paranoid delusions, pupillary dilation, insomnia, restlessness, and psychosis. Griffin said that he had seen Robert in Newgate the previous day, and that his condition seemed to have developed into mania. "He was in a condition of great mental excitement yesterday," said the doctor, "and not responsible for what he was doing." The last witness for the defence was John Cossington, a West Ham attendance officer of 36, who lived in the Barking Road. Attendance officers were employed by the local authorities to ensure that children went to school. In the spring, the punishment men, as they were known, walked the streets of their district, compiling a register of all school-aged children in houses rated at £28 or less. If a child did not turn up to at least 7 of the 10 school sessions a week, the officer would call at his or her house and issue a warning to the parents. If this was ignored, the parents were summoned to a magistrate's court, and unless able to justify the child's absence, could be fined 5 shillings. "I had reason to make inquiries in October 1893 as to the boy's non-attendance at school," Cossington told the court. "I went to the mother." Emily Coombs told him that Robert was sick through excitement. "When I did see the boy," said Cossington, "he was in a very sullen mood and would not answer me." Emily succeeded in convincing Cossington of Robert's unhappiness and his need to be moved, even to an already oversubscribed neighbouring institution. At her urging, Cossington said, he had paid a visit to Dr. Griffin, who lived across the road from him. "In consequence of what I saw, read, and heard from the doctor, and by the request of the mother that I would get him another school, I obtained a special order from the school committee for his removal from one school to another." Cossington did not allude to the nature of Robert's difficulties at Grange Road School, nor did the defence press him on this, being keen to emphasise Robert's mental instability, rather than the fact that he might have been mistreated by a teacher or bullied by other boys. When cross-examined by Gill as to why Robert had left Grange Road, Cossington said only, "The boy did not want to go back to the same school. He had stayed away from that school." Grantham did not call any further witnesses. As the defence was pleading insanity, any evidence of Robert's good character, such as the Reverend Shaw might have offered, would have done the boy no favours. In his address to the jury, Grantham said that this was one of the saddest cases ever to come before a court. He asked them to accept that Robert Coombs was insane, reminding them of the absence of motive in the case and the fact that the boy had not tried to escape. He began to expound the law on insanity, but the judge stopped him, saying that the jury must take the law from him alone. Robert's counsel sat down. Frederick Sherwood next urged the jury to acquit Fox. He insisted that the evidence showed that Fox knew nothing of the murder. "The smell in the house," he said, "only became acute on the opening of the door and disturbance of the corpse, and there is no reason for supposing that it was sufficiently present in the house as to induce Fox, a man of dull intellect, much given to smoking, and used from his dog calling to unpleasant smells, to make inquiry as to its origin or investigate its cause." "Even if the jury believed that Fox knew of the murder," said Sherwood, "he has not done a single act with the view of defeating the ends of justice or concealing the crime." Sherwood further submitted that if Robert Coombs were found insane, Fox must be acquitted. He contended that it was impossible in law to find Fox guilty of being an accessory to an insane act. This was the same argument that Kennedy had dismissed when it was proposed by Gill at the outset of the trial. But now the judge said that he agreed. Bizarrely, he even complimented Sherwood upon his discovery of the point. The argument was in fact wrong, as several legal journals subsequently explained. Since 1882, the law had stipulated that the insane could be found guilty of committing crimes, even if they were deemed not to have been culpable, and others could therefore be found guilty of abetting such crimes. Gill summed up for the Crown, submitting that Robert's insanity had not been proven. On the contrary, he said, the boy's action showed him to be a lad of exceptional capacity. He conceded that Dr. Walker's evidence was important, but as the doctor had himself said, his diagnosis of insanity was based largely on the absence of motive for the murder. The Star remarked that Gill adopted a studiously mild tone in his final speech. He was respectful of the defence's medical evidence, and seemed to leave open the possibility that Robert might be found mad. "Had Robert Coombs been a full-grown man," said Lloyds weakly, "the counsel for the prosecution would have resisted the theory of insanity, and possibly with success. But with so young a prisoner there seemed to be a desire all round to take the most lenient view." This leniency did not extend to Justice Kennedy. Though his role was supposed to be neutral, when he made his summing up at 4:40 p.m., he set out the case against Robert far more strongly than Gill had done. "The jury should not infer insanity," said Kennedy, "because someone who had led an apparently blameless life suddenly committed a callous act. Nor should they jump to the conclusion that Robert was insane, just because it was difficult to believe that a sane lad of 13 could perpetuate such an atrocious crime. He had planned the death of his mother with skill, and had displayed the most masterly sagacity afterwards. The letter to Francis Shaw might be a sham," suggested the judge, "written to simulate madness." Dr. Walker had said that homicidal mania was often accompanied by cunning, he observed. "But even Dr. Walker cannot have known before such a case as this, where the cunning and the madness were mixed up with so much pleasure and enjoyment of life." He described Natty, who was sitting in the courtroom surrounded by female relatives and neighbours, as "a little slip of a boy wholly under the thumb of his elder brother." The one relevant question, Kennedy told the jury, was whether Robert knew that what he was doing was wrong. Repeating Sherwood's incorrect assertion, he added that if they did find Robert insane, they must also acquit Fox. The sun set in the course of Kennedy's 90-minute summing up, and the gas was lit in the glass globes hanging from the courtroom ceiling. At 6:10, the jurors retired to consider their verdict. They returned at 7:12. Their foreman, a South London butcher of 37 who had 3 infant sons, confirmed to the clerk of arraigns that they had reached a verdict. "They found Robert Coombs guilty," said Harry Edes, "but they made a strong recommendation to mercy on the ground of his youth, and because they did not believe that he realized the gravity of his crime." Robert stood in the dock, his skin flushed, his eyes shining. He seemed at last alert to the seriousness of the proceedings. In the course of the day he had, for the first time, heard people stand up in court to defend him. Several witnesses had spoken kindly, even warmly, of him, his schoolteachers, his father, Amelia England, and the doctors had done their best to absolve him of responsibility. Now the jury, too, was showing him compassion. But Justice Kennedy refused to accept the recommendation of mercy. He insisted that the jurors again retire and return with one of 2 conclusions. They must find Robert guilty, or state that he was guilty of the act charge, but insane at the time. They withdrew as directed, but were back within 2 minutes. This time, in reply to the clerk's question, Harry Edes said that they found Robert Coombs guilty, but that he was insane at the time he committed the act. Robert was composed as he heard the verdict, though tears ran down his cheeks. The clerk of arraigns asked the jury, "Do you find John Fox guilty or not?" "Not guilty on the evidence," said the foreman. Edes was keen to make clear that the jurors had acquitted Fox not on the technical issue of whether he could be an accessory to an insane act, but because they believed him to be innocent. Fox was discharged. He left the dock and glided out through the courtroom, said the Star, like a somnambulist. Robert turned quickly to a warder, smiling excitedly, and whispered something to him. Natty was looking on with an air of cold unconcern that was extraordinary, according to the Star. Like Fox, he was probably more stupefied than indifferent. The judge passed sentence on Robert.
"The only judgment I can give," said Kennedy with evident displeasure, "is that the prisoner Robert Allen Coombs be detained in strict custody in the jail in Holloway until the pleasure of Her Majesty be known."
When Robert heard the sentence, his face convulsed, said the Star, as if he were about to break down in tears or to shout out in anger. He had been expecting the gallows, but a far weirder fate awaited him. Murderers detained at Her Majesty's pleasure were usually given an indefinite detention in Broadmoor, a fortified criminal lunatic asylum that housed the most notorious killers in Britain. Two Holloway warders quickly took hold of Robert and turned him to the door that led to the cells below the court. As they ushered him away, he recovered his air of detached mockery. He laughed and remarked to one of his guards, "It is all over now."
Chapter 12. Box Him Up. For the next week, Robert waited in Holloway Jail for the Home Office to arrange his admission to Broadmoor Asylum. Broadmoor, as R.J. Tuckner wrote in a short story for Reynolds' newspaper. What visions of horror, ruined lives, and blasted aspirations of madness and despair does that single word conjure up? The newspapers and journals of Britain, meanwhile, mulled over Robert's crime and his punishment. The Lancet endorsed the verdict, approving of how, with sound common sense, the jury had ignored the judge's insistence that only intellectual insanity could relieve Robert of responsibility. The boy's supposed motive for the murder was totally inadequate, the journal argued, and it was clear that he had a history of moral alienism that had culminated in impulsive homicidal mania. But few other commentators believed that Robert was mad. Rather, they concluded that the jurors had taken pity on him. "In plain English," said the Star, "they didn't want to hang the boy." The Times was glad that in these tender times they had found a way to spare him the gallows. The Spectator was appalled by such soft-heartedness. "This generation," it announced, "is going mad with pity." For those who wanted to see Robert punished, it was some consolation, at least, that he was likely to remain in the most tightly guarded asylum in Britain for the rest of his days, rather than be released, like most of those sentenced to life imprisonment after 20 years. "As he is 13 years of age," said the St. James's Gazette, "it is, on the whole, more desirable to pretend that he is mad, and so box him up in Broadmoor for life, rather than to send him for penal servitude, with the high probability that the carnivorous animal would be let loose upon the world again at 33. The language of racial atrophy pervaded the newspaper coverage. If Robert was a bloodthirsty beast to the Gazette, he was a half-formed monster to the London Daily News, and a monster of depravity to the News of the World, while the Evening News considered him among the waste products of civilization, one of the curiously morbid growths of the modern world. Before and during the Old Bailey trial, newspaper artists had depicted Robert as a classically handsome boy with even and well-proportioned features. Natty looked feebler. Some sketches emphasized the younger boy's hooded, shadowed eyes and his weak chin. The illustrations published by the Star immediately after the verdict were quite different. Robert was lumpen, dark and vacant, while Natty was a pretty child with fair curly hair. These were images drawn not from life, but from degeneration theory. The St. James's Gazette observed that Robert's schooling had not made him more civilized,
but more savage, accentuating rather than arresting the degenerative process. All that elementary education did for Master Coombs was to provide him with weapons, as it were, to sharpen the claws of the little tiger. The Daily Chronicle noted that Robert showed an eerie mixture of shrewdness and hysteria, ability and corruption, adding, "This type is not rare. It might have been foreseen as an outcome of the close-herded life of the English town, as the price of some aspects of England's greatness." "Robert Coombs was one of a new breed of urban lunatic," said the Chronicle, "a tribe of vicious, quick-witted degenerates who had replaced the grinning and harmless imbeciles that sunned themselves in the towns and villages of an older England." The Saturday Review, too, suggested that Robert's desolate environment had played a part in his regression. A lively-minded boy in the affluent West End of London could play at violence and adventure, the journal argued. He could scalp Indians in his playroom, unearth treasure beneath the trees of the square opposite his house. He had space and colour in the actual events of his life. But in West Ham, where the dingy streets reeked with malaria from the marshes and smoke from the docks, and the atmosphere was poisoned by exhalations from earth sickened by its crowded life, Robert had been driven not just to imagine, but to enact his drama. "Plaistow is practical," observed the Review dryly. This journal expressed wonder that Robert had not been scanned for the markers of degeneration. Did he show any of the signs now recognized by the great continental experts as stigmata of physical and therefore mental degeneracy? It was a test case for the application of the new knowledge. If Robert Allen Coombs is a physical criminal or madman, how about his brother, plainly an accomplice, and now turned free on society to propagate a possibly degraded strain? A lifetime's detention in an insane asylum would ensure that Robert would not reproduce, but no restrictions had been placed on Natty. The Pall Mall Gazette argued that Robert and Natty were so self-evidently depraved that both should simply have been put to death, regardless of whether they were mad. "We must all be conscious of a pang of regret that these boys are not to be hung. It would be well if we could choke such moral abortions at birth, as we now choke physical ones. But since we cannot diagnose them at sight, it is surely wiser, cheaper, and kinder to dispose of them at once, when they do declare themselves, with no more excitement or doubt than a housemaid gives to the crushing of a beetle." Taking their cue from Justice Kennedy, most journalists concluded that the Penny Dreadfuls had not played much part in the murder. The Pall Mall Gazette, which in the past had inveighed against the Dreadfuls, now declared that they were merely a scapegoat. "When a boy of the lower class murders his mother, or does similar things that he ought not to have done, what a blessing it is to get beyond elementary education, heredity, the social system, all the things we might dispute about, and find ourselves at one in blaming the Penny Dreadful for it all. Most of us have no idea what a Penny Dreadful is like. We only know that little boys buy them in dark shops in back streets, and there is nobody to defend them. Therefore, down with the Penny Dreadful." "The truth is," said the Gazette, "that in respect to the effect of reading on boys of the poorer class, the world has got into one of those queer, illogical stupidities that so easily beset it. In every other age and class, man is held responsible for his reading, and not reading responsible for man. The books a man or woman reads are less the making of character than the expression of it." The Journal of Mental Science agreed. "It seems obvious that while stories full of bloodshed and horrors might help to confirm and encourage, and even to give direction to, a tendency already existing, they cannot be considered responsible for the origination of such a tendency." Others pointed out that there was no real difference between the trashy books in the back parlour of 35 Cave Road and classics such as Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. The hero of that novel, like Robert,
was a boy full of sea dreams, bewitched by anticipations of strange islands and adventures. The Duchess of Rutland noted that there were guinea dreadfuls as well as penny dreadfuls. Some journalists even expressed a rueful sympathy for Robert's fantasies. His murder plot was borrowed from the stock-in-trade, not only of the penny dreadful, but of all the literature of boys' adventure, said the Saturday Review. The purchase of a knife from a marine store dealer, the hiding of it, the secret talks with an admiring brother, the choice of pretexts for the deed, he would call it a deed, the signal from the other room, and the swift and sudden action. We know them all, and we can understand how they engrossed his mind to the exclusion of all else. Robert yearned for the island of children's fiction, observed the review, its rocks no doubt covering hidden treasure, its shores littered with attractive wrecks. Even John Fox was a familiar figure of the genre. The faithful retainer, not fully in the confidence of his master, but ready to serve him to the death, and possessed, no doubt, of a practical knowledge of islands. The cozy retreat in the back parlour recalled the hideaway of a band of fugitives. Robert, Natty and Fox played cards in their den, no doubt, with fierce oaths, and began their adventures by sleeping on unaccustomed couches. The Star reporter, who attended the Old Bailey trial, also recognized the boy's dreams. "Alas, that island," he lamented. "We all wanted to get there in our day, to live in a hut and shoot pirates and slavers, though happily the road there was less bloodthirsty than that which unhappy Robert Coombs chose." The origin of the crime was still a mystery. In their bid to secure an insanity verdict, Robert's lawyers had tried to wipe out motive rather than to find it. Their medical witnesses had characterized the killing as a psychic spasm with no emotional content or meaning. The newspapers, too, placed the blame for the murder on Robert's physiology, though most argued that his degeneracy had rendered him immoral rather than insane. Just one publication argued that Robert might be neither mad nor bad. The Child's Guardian, the journal of the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, proposed that the cause of the crime lay not in the boy's disordered body, but in the history of his home, specifically in his relationship with his mother. "Of the dead we speak no ill in courts," it observed in October, in a piece entitled Boy Murderers. "Of the dead in this particular case we know no ill to speak, but we are of opinion that it is of great public concern to know what were the relations of the dead mother and her murderous child." The Child's Guardian suggested, as the lawyers had not, that Robert had assaulted Emily Coombs because she was physically brutal. This, after all, was what Robert had said. He had told the police that he had decided to kill his mother because she had beaten Natty and threatened them both, and that he finally attacked her because she punched him as he lay in bed. He had told Dr. Walker that he had killed her because she had thrown knives at Natty and warned that she would stick a hatchet in his head. The Child's Guardian pointed out that Natty had colluded in the murder plan. "Was he, too, insane?" it asked skeptically. Legislation had been passed to protect children from violent parents. The Children's Acts of 1889 and 1894 stipulated that physical correction should be reasonable and within the bounds of moderation. But neither the police, the coroner, the solicitor, nor the magistrate in the Coombs case seemed to have inquired into the frequency, force, or emotion with which Emily beat her boys. They accepted Natty's and the neighbours' assurances that she was kind to her sons, and ignored Robert's accounts of her threats and aggression. As the Child's Guardian suggested, this was in part because it was unseemly to speak ill of the dead, especially of a murdered woman. Whatever she had done, she had not deserved this.
Most people, in any case, believed that parents were entitled to punish their children by whatever means they felt necessary, and the Coombs family appeared to be a respectable, church-going household, neither dissipated nor desperate. Nonetheless, the NSPCC, which had been prosecuting parents for cruelty since its inception in 1884, had no difficulty in believing the worst. That brute force begets brute force, and injustice injustice, is beyond doubt, it observed. That there are thousands of parents, both fathers and mothers, whose conduct to their children is worse than barbarous, the records of this society's work during but a few years places beyond doubt. In a booklet published a few years later, the NSPCC reminded its inspectors of the need to interpret the language used by children. "What the starved child calls stealing may not be stealing," advised the inspector's directory, 1901. "Yet as his parents call it stealing, the child calls it so too. Never take a frightened, ill-treated child's names for its actions. Find out in particular what those actions were." This applied not only to Natty's crime, the stealing of food, but also to his punishment. The boys adopted their mother's description of the hiding she administered, but the event may have been much more alarming than that term implied. "Violent parents not only inflicted physical suffering on their children," observed the child's guardian, "but also caused psychological degradation. As the older and favoured boy, Robert occupied a confusing position in his household. Sometimes his mother punished him as a child, sometimes enlisted him as a companion. The intensity of their relationship was particularly acute when his father was away, a closeness made literal on the nights that he slept alongside her." The NSPCC journal stopped short of addressing the oddity of a 13-year-old boy sharing his mother's bed, though such arrangements were usually witnessed only in slums and tenements that did not have enough space for adults and older children to sleep apart. Drawing in the Illustrated Police News picked up on the sexual symbolism of the murder scene. Robert is shown plunging a knife through the half-revealed breast of his mother while holding a truncheon at his groin. Pain is inscribed on the faces of both mother and son, one twisted in grief and the other in rage. Next to this image of savage and debauched frenzy, the newspaper published a sketch of Robert as a smooth-faced, clean-cut schoolboy standing in the dock. The Illustrated Police News images dramatized the bewildering duality of Robert's behavior. He was the good boy and the bad, child and man, beast and sophisticate. "Robert appears to have two personalities," wrote the Times critic J.F. Nisbet, "two memories which remain distinct." His case played to the contemporary preoccupation with double selves. "Every person consists of two personalities," the French psychologist Pierre Janet had argued in 1886, "one conscious and one unconscious." Frederick Myers, a founder of the Society for Psychical Research, identified a subliminal self that lay below the threshold of ordinary consciousness. "Two or more distinct trains of memory, feeling, will, may exist in the same personage," wrote Myers in 1892. He proposed that the buried self communicated with the conscious mind by such means as auditory hallucination. Others speculated that unconscious selves might be revealed by hypnotism and mesmerism, or break forth spontaneously in somnambulism, epilepsy, and homicidal insanity. "Man is not truly one," says Dr. Jekyll in The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, "but truly two." By killing his mother, Robert had tried to resolve an intolerable tension, to simplify his divided self. Part 4. The Murderer's Paradise. Chapter 13. Those That Know Not What They Do. On Monday, 23 September, 6 days after his conviction, Robert Coombs and two warders from Holloway Jail travelled by train to a village in Berkshire, 40 miles southwest of London. Robert was wearing his cricketing trousers, his tennis jacket with gold piping, and a pair of handcuffs by which he was attached to one of his guards. The day was blazing hot, but the boy was very cool and collected, reported the Hampshire Telegraph. He returned the glances of the passengers who travelled with him with careless smiles. A carriage met Robert and his guards at the railway station, and they were driven up the hill and along the thickly wooded road to Broadmoor Asylum. A group of tall, red-turreted buildings encircled by a 16-foot wall. The asylum gate was set in an archway flanked by towers and topped by a clock of blackened gold. A turnkey unlocked the gate, and the cab passed through the arch to a courtyard. Robert was uncuffed, taken into the building, and officially admitted to the asylum. His occupation was entered in the register as labourer in ironworks. His crime, murder of his mother by stabbing her with a knife. He was sent to a bathroom, where an attendant watched over him while he bathed, and another took away his jacket and trousers and replaced them with a long calico nightshirt. His belongings were listed and stored. He was allotted a bed in one of the admissions wards in the asylum's central complex, where he would remain while his mental condition was assessed. Since he was considered a suicide risk, he was observed closely. During Robert's first week in Broadmoor, the sun shone from dawn to dusk in a cloudless sky, and the temperature repeatedly reached 80 degrees Fahrenheit. It was the hottest September ever recorded. The admissions wards faced south, with a view through French windows to the open country at the front of the asylum, an undulating landscape of pastures, knolls and copses, run through by dark belts of pine and fir. Between the lawns and flower beds on the terrace outside the ward, a gravel drive was shaded from the bright sky by an avenue of limes. Below the drive the ground fell away gently in richly planted terraces to the foot of the ridge. The wall bounding the southern reach of the estate lay beneath the terraces. It was as idyllic a prospect as a city boy like Robert had ever seen. In this pastoral setting, the inmates of Broadmoor were returned to a kind of innocence. They were stripped of their freedoms and responsibilities, rendered as powerless and unencumbered as children. In Broadmoor, they were unlikely to be reproached for their crimes. They entered a suspended existence, with little reference to the past or the future, a strange corollary to the dissociated, dreamlike state that often attended psychosis. The asylum was both jail and sanctuary, fortress and enchanted castle. The spell by which the patients were bound within its walls could be lifted only at the behest of the Queen. Robert was interviewed by one of the asylum's four doctors within a few days of his admission. When questioned as to the murder of his mother, the physician wrote in his notes, he at first pretended to have forgotten the occurrence, but subsequently admitted the deed. Robert may genuinely, if briefly, have lost his memory of the killing, as he had done in Holloway. His grasp of the crime he had committed was fitful and unsteady. To survive the horror of the murder, Robert needed to forget. To recover from it, he would need to remember. Broadmoor was built in the early 1860s to house the growing number of men and women found insane in the criminal courts. Its first patients were transferred from the Bethlehem Asylum in London in 1864, and the institution now held almost 500 men and more than 150 women. Just under half of the men had committed homicide, and about half of these had killed a member of his family. Robert became one of 12 male inmates who had murdered their mothers. Of the women in Broadmoor, who were housed in a separate part of the asylum, 80% had killed one or more of their children. In October, Robert was joined in the admissions ward by two more patients who had been convicted at the Old Bailey. Henry Jackson, an unemployed postman in his 20s, had suffocated his 6-month-old baby.
He seemed to hear a voice, not human, telling him to do the deed, Dr. Walker of Holloway Jail testified at his trial, and he felt he must kill the child, and after he had done it he felt a satisfaction.
Jackson was apparently suffering from the same species of mania, the compulsion to kill, the relief after killing, that Dr. Walker had identified in Robert. Yet the insanity verdict in his case, too, masked the difficulty and unhappiness that lay behind his violent act. Henry Jackson's mother described the very tangible pressures on her son. He and his family were in a state of dreadful distress after he lost his job, she said, having sold everything they owned in order to buy food. The other arrival, Carmelo Mussi, had shot at his landlord before trying to take his own life. Mussi was an elderly Italian, wispy-haired, grey-whiskered, lame, his speech a garbled blur of French, English, and his native tongue, often punctuated by sobs. The Old Bailey jury, moved by his vulnerability, had found him guilty but insane. The judge complained afterwards that the jury's mercy was misguided. He had intended to give Mussi a light sentence, but the insanity verdict meant that the old man, like all the pleasure men in Broadmoor, might never be free again. Robert's situation was similar. If he had been found simply guilty, his death sentence would almost certainly have been commuted. No one under the age of 16 had been hanged in England since the execution in 1831 of the 14-year-old John Bell, who had killed another boy. But the combination of Justice Kennedy's intransigence and the jury's pity had ensured that his detention would be indefinite.
"Those with long experience at the Old Bailey," asserted the Sheffield Independent when Robert was convicted, "remark that no case is on record of a person sentenced as a criminal lunatic ever being released." This was a common misconception. Several Broadmoor inmates were discharged each year. But most inmates did remain within its walls until they died. After a few weeks, each new patient was assigned to one of Broadmoor's 6 blocks, which contained up to 100 men apiece. The heavily staffed blocks 1 and 6, the back blocks, set against the woods behind the asylum, were inhabited by those patients who were considered dangerous to themselves or others. Blocks 3 and 4, which contained the infirmary and the admissions wards, were for the men who needed fairly constant supervision. Blocks 2 and 5 were the lightly staffed privilege blocks, for patients whose behaviour was more or less sane. Of the two, Block 2 was reserved for the more socially able and educated inmates. Robert, being young and therefore relatively impressionable, was sent to this building. Block 2 sat to the side and slightly forward of the main complex and enjoyed fine views over the surrounding country. The building was 250 foot long and 3 stories high. Most of its inhabitants were housed in single chambers, 12 foot long and 8 foot wide, each furnished with a bed, a desk, and a cupboard. Their windows were fitted with iron bars. Robert was issued with a toothbrush, hairbrush, and comb, and with a set of clothes, 2 day shirts, several sets of underwear and a flannel vest, a pair of strong grey trousers and a dark grey jacket. Each morning, at 6 a.m. in summer and 7 a.m. in winter, Robert's door was unlocked, and he rose to empty his chamber pot, wash himself with a flannel at a stand in his room, and dress for the day. He took a breakfast of tea, bread and butter in the Block 2 dining room at the back of the building. Afterwards, he and the other patients were released to the airing court for their first period of exercise. An attendant drew the bolts on the main door and then turned his key in the lock to let the men out, while another attendant stood by to count them as they passed. 3 out. 4 out. Security was tight in Broadmoor. There had been only 6 successful escapes from the asylum in 30 years, the most recent in 1888. The Block 2 airing court encompassed several terraces below the main buildings. In spring, Its fruit trees blossomed against the weathered red brick of the asylum walls. In summer, the beds brimmed with flowers, while sycamore and chestnut trees afforded shelter from the sun. A few attendants kept watch as the men played croquet, smoked and chatted, or walked alone. Some patients tended to their private gardens, small patches of land on which they could grow fruit and vegetables to eat or trade. The allotments were planted with strawberries, raspberries, cucumbers, tomatoes, plum trees, carnations. Thomas Henry Townsend, who had plotted to assassinate the Prime Minister in 1893, used to walk in the gardens gazing at the plants. "I love beautiful things," he explained. His failure to kill Gladstone, by his own account, stemmed from similarly tender instincts. "He gave me such a sweet smile that he melted my heart," Townsend would say, "and I just couldn't pull the trigger." The patients were counted again as they returned to the block after each spell in the airing court. 5 in, 6 in, and so on. Once they were all back in the building, the door was closed. The bolts were rattled into their sockets. The key was turned in the lock, and the ring buckled back on the attendant's belt. Most of the patients' food came from the asylum farm, which grew crops and raised cows, pigs, and sheep. The meals were prepared in a central kitchen and delivered to the block dining rooms. A typical dinner, served at about 12:30 p.m., was mutton, beef or pork, with potatoes or vegetables, followed by a steamed raisin or fruit pudding, and accompanied by tea or weak beer. The Block 2 men were permitted to use knives at mealtimes, but the cutlery was counted out of the canteen as it was handed to the patients, and counted back in once the meal was over. If the numbers did not tally, no patient could leave the block until the missing implement was found. As well as the dining hall, the ground floor of Block 2 housed a pantry, a scullery, the attendants' offices, a billiards room, and a day room. The day room had an open fireplace, upholstered benches along the walls, plants and flowers in pots and vases, and chairs and tables at which the patients could read and write or play card games. Through the barred windows, they could see the shallow valley and hills beyond the asylum. The tables were scattered with weekly periodicals such as Punch and daily newspapers, from which the attendants had snipped out any articles that they believed might hurt or excite a patient's feelings. Block 2 was the only block to have its own library. The books, which were chosen by the chaplain, included Hardy's Jude the Obscure. The inmates' health, comfort and cleanliness were monitored closely. The common areas were heated by open fires and by warm air fanned up through grates in the floor. The temperature was regulated to 60 degrees in the day rooms, 55 in the dining room, 50 in the corridor. In 1896, the Block 2 urinals were supplemented with teak-seated flushing lavatories. The asylum's own plant burnt coal to supply gas for lighting, and from 1897, its engine house was able to run hot water to the blocks. On one evening a week, Robert took a warm bath. An attendant supervised, handing him a brush and carbolic soap with which to wash himself, and carefully measuring the water temperature with a thermometer. The bath was heated to between 90 and 96 degrees Fahrenheit. As Robert grew older, an attendant shaved his face 3 times a week, while another stood by to ensure that the razor remained in his colleague's charge. The attendants were watchful about any means by which a patient might harm himself or others. No matches were allowed in the wards. The attendants lit the inmates' cigarettes, pipes and cigars. No mops, brooms or pokers were left lying about. All cupboards were kept locked, all fires extinguished at bedtime. When dark fell, the common rooms and corridors were lit by mantled coal gas lamps. Robert was given a supper of bread, butter and tea before being sent to bed at 7:45 p.m. and bolted into his room at 8. He slept under a sheet and blanket on a horsehair mattress stuffed and sewn in an asylum workshop. Throughout the night, the attendants made regular trips down the long corridors,
checking on the patients by shining torches through narrow glazed apertures in the bedroom doors. The Broadmoor superintendent was Dr. David Nicholson, who at the time of Robert's admission had run the asylum for almost a decade. Nicholson was tall, broad and jowly, with a bulbous nose and a drooping walrus moustache. A protégé of the pioneering Broadmoor superintendent William Orange, Nicholson took a liberal and humane line on crime and insanity. He was an outspoken opponent of criminal anthropology. The idea of hereditary criminality was a dangerous nonsense, he said in July 1895, because it does not include circumstance and motive in the computation, and because without these no standard of capacity or of conduct or of responsibility can be regarded as trustworthy or even possible. Nicholson also held a broad view of what constituted an insane crime, and would have had no difficulty with the idea that Robert Coombs's murder of his mother, though premeditated, was an act of madness. "An insane man has frequently a definite purpose of committing the act," he said, "and a clear knowledge of the results." Since he believed that madness was at least partly caused by a person's surroundings and experience, Nicholson tried in Broadmoor to foster an environment conducive to sanity. Unlike prison governors, he rarely employed attendants with military backgrounds. "I prefer to train up an ordinary man," he said. "Perhaps it might be a labouring man or an artisan, because there is not so much of the toe-the-line business on their part as a soldier naturally has, and which is necessary in prisons. There is more of the element and idea of nursing with us. That is to say, we have to get the inmates to rub along somehow from day to day." In keeping with the precepts of moral management established earlier in the century, Nicholson impressed on his attendants the need to be gentle and sympathetic towards the patients. They were encouraged to accommodate erratic behaviour and to quietly ignore delusions. The Handbook for the Instruction of Attendants on the Insane, 1885, known as the Red Book, advised asylum attendants to exercise such tact as will comfort the depressed, soothe the excited, and check the impulsive, irritable, and destructive. "Some of the patients," observed the attendant's companion, 1892, "like elder children, may be trusted to do many things for themselves. Others, like younger children, must have everything done for them." In the asylum, Robert was treated as a child among children. The Broadmoor staff used no mechanical restraints, such as straitjackets and fetters. There was not even a padded room on the premises. Instead, an attendant was taught to summon help if a patient became unruly, and then to try with one or more other staff to hold the patient until he or she was calm. If a struggle was unavoidable, the attendants were warned never to place their knees on an inmate, nor to twist his or her limbs in any way. The asylum rule stipulated that kindness and forbearance should be the touchstones of the patient's treatment. Drugs were used sparingly. Morphine was occasionally dispensed as a sedative, brandy as a tonic. The only therapies were the tranquil setting, the steadiness of the staff, and the pattern of the days. The attendants at Broadmoor were better paid than those at other asylums. Most earned between £45 and £80 a year, while the chief attendant received £130, and some remained at the institution for life. In 1895, almost 80% of the staff had served at Broadmoor for more than 5 years, and 60% for more than 10. They did not always live up to the standard set out in the rule books, but very few incidents of ill-treatment were recorded in the ledger of staff misdemeanours. Rather, the attendants were occasionally penalised for being late or drunk, for sitting down in a day-room to read a newspaper or take a nap, for leaving the medicine cabinet open, miscounting the inmates, flirting with female patients, or failing to notice a missing spoon. Within a few months of Robert's arrival, Nicholson was succeeded as medical superintendent by Richard Brain,
a dapper, clean-shaven man who had previously worked as a doctor in the prison service. He was employed on a salary of £900. His deputy earned £500, and the two other doctors in the asylum, £225 and £180 a year. Brain gained a reputation as a strict superintendent, though this was based principally on his increased use of solitary confinement in the back blocks. His views about the inmates were similar to those of his predecessors. He would remind visitors to the asylum that his charges were morally innocent. They were patients, not prisoners, and they had no need to expiate their crimes. Brain and Nicholson worked together on home office assignments before and after Brain took charge of the asylum. In October 1895, when Robert had just been admitted to Broadmoor, the two doctors were asked by the Home Secretary to appraise the mental condition of Oscar Wilde, who was still being held at Wandsworth Prison. After examining Wilde, Brain and Nicholson concluded that he was not mentally ill, but suggested that his conditions be improved. He should be moved to a prison outside London, they recommended, and given more food, more space, and more books. They advised that it was dangerous to his mental well-being to deprive him of a wide range of literature. Wilde was transferred in November to Reading Jail. Under Brain's stewardship, the life of Block 2 continued as before. The well-known war correspondent, George Stevens, on a visit to Broadmoor in 1897, was taken by Brain to the Block 2 day room. A dozen or so patients were sitting around, some reading and some playing cards. Like the other journalists who toured the asylum, Stevens was asked not to identify any of the inmates, but was otherwise free to report on what he saw. "The day room," wrote Stevens in an article published in the Daily Mail, "looked like the smoking room of a comfortable but unpretentious hotel. Here was a quiet, trim, scholarly-looking man who had pushed his wife over a cliff. There, a rougher, ragged, bearded elder who had throttled his senior partner. There, reading the Daily Mail, a mild-eyed visionary whose mission in life is to kill a royal person." Stevens noticed two attendants in dark blue uniforms standing by like waiters. Quiet, decorous, tactful, but vigilant. The patients bade the superintendent good afternoon, and paid no more attention to his guest than the residents of a gentleman's club would have paid to another member's visitor. Robert Coombs was the youngest inmate of Broadmoor by several years. There were no other patients below the age of 20, and only the fourth boy ever to have been admitted to the asylum. Yet the mature and cultivated manners of some of his fellow residents concealed crimes quite as desperate as his own. Among the patriarchs of the asylum was an engineer called Nathaniel Currer from Lambeth in South London. In 1887, Currer's 13-year-old daughter Beatrice had pleaded with her parents to let her join George and Olga Goring's troop of acrobat cyclists, and they had reluctantly agreed. Beatrice spent the next year on tour with the trick cyclists in England, France, and Germany, sometimes performing five times a night at different theatres and music halls. Over the months she became sickly and weak. The Gorings disguised her skeletal legs by wrapping her shins in bandages and tights before she was seen on stage. One night she was so feeble that she dropped a young boy in the troupe, a slip that provoked hissing from the audience. In June 1888, the Gorings decided that she was too ill to perform and sent her home to Lambeth. Beatrice's condition worsened, and in December she died of consumption. Upon his daughter's death, the once amiable Currer went mad with grief. He would wake screaming in the night, and by day he shuffled about muttering to himself, swearing and tying knots in lengths of string. He tried to prosecute the Gorings for cruelty and neglect, but he met with no success in the courts. One night in June 1889, he made his way to the stage door of the Canterbury Music Hall in Lambeth and waited until George Goring and his entourage arrived in their private omnibus. As Goring alighted, Currer lunged forward and stabbed the acrobat in the stomach. "I've got you this time, old boy," he cried. He then drew a pistol
and shot himself. Goring died of his wounds. Currer survived to be charged with murder. The Old Bailey jury found him unfit to plead, being undeniably insane, in the words of the doctor who examined him, full of hallucinations and illusions, and he was sent to Broadmoor without standing trial. Currer had tried to punish both of the men whom he blamed for Beatrice's death, Goring and himself. His act of violence was driven, like the crimes of many inmates of the asylum, by a deranging fusion of rage and shame. In Broadmoor, Currer became again a peaceful, jovial fellow. When the celebrated author and journalist George Sims visited the asylum in the late 1890s, he found Currer in a day-room smoking a briar-root pipe. The grey-haired, ruddy-faced old man engaged the visitor in conversation. He proved eager to discuss Sims's writings, particularly a series of poems about the plight of the poor. Sims was struck by Currer's warm, lilting voice and his soft blue eyes. As he left, he noticed that Currer returned to reading a copy of Charles Dickens's Little Dorrit, a novel in which the young heroine comforts and forgives her aged, imprisoned father. Several of Robert's fellow Block 2 inmates had more directly destroyed their children. Richard Oakes, a chemist, had been confined in the asylum since 1890, when he and his wife had been so financially desperate that they had decided to poison themselves and their 8-year-old son Arthur. In a suicide note, Oakes explained, "We have, God forgive us, taken our darling Artie with us out of pure love and affection, so that the darling should never be cuffed about, or reminded, or taunted with his heartbroken parents' crime." The strychnine quickly killed the boy, but the dose was insufficient to kill the parents, and when their landlady found them, both were lying in a blood-soaked bed, having tried to finish themselves off by cutting their throats with razors. They were charged with murder and attempted self-murder, found guilty but insane, and sent to Broadmoor. In the asylum, Oakes was tranquil and well-behaved, and showed no signs of insanity. He rarely saw his wife. The Broadmoor men had no contact with the women, except at chapel on Sundays. And even then, the men were all seated on the ground floor, facing the front, by the time the women were allowed to file into the first-floor gallery. An attendant found Oakes dead in his room in Block 2 in November 1895, aged 64, apparently